put 50,000 candy money in the slot, right?
300 Quaker, probably in the slot, up to 0.
They steal the store, they charge the kids.
Okay, I'm on the northbound access. Just right at the light.
Look, can I be across the house in the
big time? I think we can set it up again.
If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/ganglandwire. Follow true crime storyteller Gary Jenkins on Twitter at Jenks Law. Buy the DVD Gangland Wire or download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, welcome back, folks. This is segment three of the Chicago Mob and the Kansas City Mob and how they became connected and what they have done together. And tonight, we're going to talk about the kind of the ultimate, the culmination of their efforts that really paid off big time for a period of time, but also led to their downfall. It's kind of interesting. I have with me here tonight, of course, my good friend Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
and our good friend Bill Owsley's here tonight. Say hello, Bill.
Yeah, good evening. Glad to be here.
And you know, Bill is a retired FBI agent who has written two books about the mafia in Kansas City, and he goes into a lot of this connection with Chicago in those books. It's the first book is Open City. And the second book, say a little bit about your second book, Bill, Mobsters in Our Midst.
Yeah, Mobsters in Our Midst follows the career of the longest reigning boss in Kansas City's mob history, Nick Civella, and from his coronation to his death, and a very, very active time in Kansas City's history.
Well, that's for sure. I was lucky enough to be a member of the Kansas City Police Intelligence Unit during the 1970s, which was the most active time, I would say. And we had the River Key, and then we had the skin investigation. We handled in Kansas City, and it was really interesting and an active time, a good time to be a member of the Kansas City Police Intelligence Unit. I know that, and we worked closely with the FBI and. So it was a lot of fun, and let's go on. Let me recap just a little bit where we are. By now, in the 40s, Nick Civella had gotten in trouble with the local mob. He had gone to Chicago. He had come back, and then the contract was still on him because he had been robbing mob-protected games in particular, and he probably had other little pieces of action going. He wasn't kicking upstairs, you know. If a mob guy makes some money, he's got to kick upstairs, and he was not a made guy at the time, probably, that would be ordered to kick upstairs, but he was a criminal associate, shall we say, and would enjoy certain protections, maybe, or ask for certain protections, and anyhow, he was not doing what they wanted, and he had there was an attempted murder, attempted hit on him at a liquor store parking lot, in which the Jackson County Deputy Sheriff got killed accidentally, it appears, and he went back to Chicago, and when he came back the last time, after the war, probably 46 or 47, maybe even up to 19, before 1950, we know that, he comes back, and he seems to be in, all seems to be forgiven, and Bill talked a lot about whether he was really forgiven or not, and what happened to him, and he ends up, what we know is there's a mob, kind of a underboss or a higher ranking person named Anthony Gizzo at that time, who was closely connected to some Chicago mobsters, a guy named Charles Cherry Nose Gio and Anthony Accardo, and he knew them very well. And when Nick Civella comes back from Chicago and it appears maybe all is forgiven, he becomes Gizzo's driver, and Gizzo takes him under his wing and drives him around. I remember during the skim investigation, all these guys usually have somebody who's kind of like their buddy. They call him their comp, that they kind of brought in. Tuffy DeLuna had, what was that guy's name, Bill?
Charlie Moratino.
Charlie Moratino was his guy, and they kind of like didn't do anything without the other one knew what they were doing and what was going on. And so that appeared to be the relationship between Gizzo and Nick Civella when he came back. And Gizzo, shortly thereafter, rises to be the mob boss. But by, this is 1950, the two Charlies have been killed, Charlie Bonaggio and Charlie Gargano, and Gizzo is on his way up. It's widely believed that Nick Civella maybe orchestrated that, and that was part of his dues when he came back into Kansas City. And Gizzo rises to be the boss, but in 1953, he dies. And so where is our friend Nick Civella and his Chicago backing placed? He's placed right next to Anthony Gizzo, and he's a natural guy to move on up to be at least the boss of the day-to-day activities and that people will know about. Now, back behind the scenes, there are people like Tano Lococo and Joe Filardo who are pulling some of the strings and kind of supposedly have a, what would you call that, a merit status. They have these school professors. They say they're a professor emeritus. They're still there and they have an office, but they don't really have to do anything. And so Filardo, and how we know that Filardo, he was friends with Civella. He liked Nick Civella. And how we know that Nick rose on up to be the boss is the famous Appalachian Convention. Joe Filardo and Nick Civella are caught there back in New York with all the mob bosses from all over the United States. And so that pretty much lets everybody know the ranking of Nick Civella at that point in time. And so, you know, in the 1960s in Chicago, they have the same thing going on. They've got a mafia and they've got the old black hand guys and they've got these new guys that are rising up. And there was a guy named Joseph and they called him Joey Doves Iupa. Rising in the ranks, and he would become a shall we say, an associate of Nick Civella. I'm not sure what their, how far back they went, whether Nick knew him back in the day or not. Do you, Bill? I don't think that's really reported anywhere, is it?
No, not the date or anything like that. But as Nick became established as boss, he would have become familiar with most of the hierarchy of the Chicago family. And interestingly enough, Joey Doves got his start as a chauffeur. So their paths were similar. But Nick would have known all of those main people up there.
Yeah. And you know, another thing about Iupa is Tony Accardo had some kind of legal problems and Iupa kind of rose on up. Well, Accardo was kind of in the background pulling some strings, but not actually doing things, whereas Iupa was out doing more things in, by the 60s, if what I read is right. Is that correct?
Well, Accardo, there were several people after Accardo, one of them being Momo Giancana, who followed Accardo as the boss. And we know that Giancana and Civella were close, had good ties. Giancana was murdered, and I think a guy named Battaglia then took over, and then after that, Iupa became the boss. But during all of this this period of time, people like Iupa, just like Tony Gizzo, may not have had the stature or the name boss. But these were people that were intricately involved with what was going on, policy making, and what have you.
So, you know, by the 70s, they come upon a scheme. The mob has always, as long as Las Vegas has been out there, they wanted to get a piece of that action. Anytime you've got addiction and money, cash money flowing, and people are addicted to that stuff, and it's kind of edgy anyhow, whether it's strip clubs or narcotics operations or gambling and legal gambling, illegal gambling, the mob's going to be there because it's ripe for corruption. It's ripe to snake that cash money out of there. And so during this time, the Chicago, Cleveland, and Milwaukee, and the Kansas City mobs all had these different Teamsters. We did a whole program on the mob and the Teamsters, and Cleveland had Jackie Presser, and Milwaukee had a guy named Frank Rainey, I believe, and Chicago had a guy named Alan Dorfman, and of course, Kansas City had Roy Lee Williams, who was the Teamsters boss of Local 41 here in Kansas City, and all the other surrounding smaller Teamsters locals in the area, and they all operated on the national level, had influence over the Central States Teamsters Pension Fund, and so those four mob families all combined to agree that the Central States Teamsters Pension Fund, using their Teamsters that they owned to get the approval, would loan a man named Alan Gleck $62 million to buy four casinos, and he put under the umbrella corporation called Argent Corporation. Alan Gleck had the Stardust, the Tropicana, I mean the Stardust, the Hacienda, the Marina, and the Fremont. Is that, that's right.
The Frontier?
Or the Frontier, right, the Frontier. Not the Frontier.
No, no, was it Fremont, Hacienda, the Stardust, Fremont, Hacienda, and
Marina.
The Marina.
Yeah, and the Stardust was the main one. That was where all the money was made. They had a big casino there, and they put a guy named Lefty Rosenthal in there to help set up the skim. And that was going to go back to Chicago, and then Chicago would share back with these other cities.
And Lefty was a Chicago guy.
Chicago, he was a Chicago guy. Grew up in Chicago, had traveled around the country and done other things, was a gambler and got ran out of Florida, I believe, and then ended up in Las Vegas, and he was a Chicago guy. He was their guy. Mm-hmm. And in that world, as Bill says in the movie, if you've seen my movie, in that world, if they own you, you're their guy, then you're their guy, and that's how they refer to you, is that's our guy. They refer to Roy Williams as that's our guy, Alan Dorfman. And so here's a good example of that. I'm going to play this little clip. Alan Dorfman was a pretty important Teamster, and had a lot of influence over this, the money in the Central States Teamsters Pension Fund and other, all other Teamsters activities. And Joy Iupa didn't get in there and grub around on the day-to-day stuff, just like Nick Savella didn't either. He had Tuffy DeLuna do that. He sent Tuffy DeLuna out to Las Vegas to try to straighten Alan Gleck out at one point in time. And in Chicago, Iupa had a guy called Joy the Clown, or Joseph Lombardo. And so I'm going to play a little clip of a tape that we got in the Strawman case of Joy Lombardo threatening a casino owner named Morris Schenker. And what he's threatening him for is not kicking back some money to Teamsters official Alan Dorfman, because, as he says, Chicago has a piece of Dorfman. So play that. No, play that tape. Okay, so that's that is a real deal. That is a real deal mafia threat on a person, a death threat. They've got this skim going, and you know, another thing about the Chicago KC relationship. Now, this, you know, this doesn't seem a close, like any extra close relationship, but Nick Savella, he's smarter than the average mob boss. He sets up his own mole at the Tropicana, a man named Joe Augusto, and he sets up a totally separate stream of skim money, as much $40,000 a month, from the Tropicana back to Kansas City. Well, Chicago, because they had to have the okay of the Kansas City, Milwaukee, and Cleveland mobs to get this done, they've been kicking part of it back. Well, Kansas City didn't have to have their okay. They didn't have to use the Teamsters' money to do this. They did this. Nick Savella did this all on his own with this, using this Joe Augusto. And what did Nick Savella do with that money? Did he keep that all that for himself, Bill?
Well, no. As you say, he was astute enough to understand that he didn't have an obligation to share his skim because it was separate and independent of Teamster Fund loans. He, on his own, agreed to share a portion of that skim with Iupa and his family, one out of respect and one out of knowing that it would enhance his position. It's indicative of that this is a cunning guy.
It puts him in a position of Chicago kind of owes him.
Well, when he does this, though, I mean, he's now revealing that he's got a secondary skim coming.
Well,
and they've all already met and agreed that they've got Rosenthal running the place and Dorfman owning it in front of the Argent Corporation, right? And then the skim goes back to Chicago where it's divvied up and each city gets their share.
There's nothing secret in Las Vegas, and the fact that Nick had infiltrated the Tropicana
was simply they own it. They just infiltrated it.
They had a Joe Augusto get himself wheedled in a position of management and control.
Wasn't he a dishwasher?
No, well,
that's what he said.
In his early days, that's what he said. When in his history, he had gone to Alaska and he was a dishwasher. But protocol is what's important here. And even though Chicago and Milwaukee and all the others knew that Nick had a piece of the trop, they couldn't demand satisfaction. That was Nick's. He did it himself. It had nothing to do with them. He had no obligation to share, and that was understood.
Yeah. And because Vegas, in part, was an open city.
Right, exactly. And but by Nick saying to Chicago, hey, you know, this is a brotherhood.
Yeah.
And here's a piece of what I have, was a very, very smart move. Because you have to understand that after Apalachin, and as time went on, the National Commission had trouble meeting. And what they did is they gave Chicago everything west of the Mississippi River. So, in effect, Chicago was the commission for all the families west of the Mississippi River.
And interesting. I didn't really think about it like that, but that would make sense.
That's why they were the chief honcho and stuff. Things had to flow through them. And so Nick, you know,
realizing this.
Well, you know, as I say, he's a cunning guy. Plus, there was a bond with Chicago. And so he, on his own, split what they were able to get with Chicago. So you, as you notice, not with Milwaukee or Cleveland. You know, it was he split with Chicago. Stardust skim had to be split because they also all had a piece
of that
of the approval from the Teamster.
So, you know, and talking about Nick and Chicago and Joey Iuffa is at one point in time, again, I don't want to confuse you guys. You got to remember Tropicana is separate from the Stardust. Now, if you saw the movie Casino, that and the Robert De Niro character, he played a character who was Ace Rustin in the movie, but the real person, that's based on this skimming operation out of the Stardust, not the Trop, but the Stardust only, was a guy named Frank Lefty Rosenthal, which was Chicago's guy, and we talked about this earlier. So Lefty was a guy who got out of control. The Nevada Gaming Commission had kind of changed, and they started cracking down a little bit more than they had in the past. And they had an attorney general named Bob List, who was trying to make a name for himself and wanted to be governor. And he went after Lefty because Lefty had a felony conviction. He really could not have what we call a key person license. In a casino, they have a license called a key person. And that means you're key in the operation of the gambling, and you have to have a really extensive background check and pass it before you can have a key person license. And Lefty was, in fact, running the Stardust and the Alan Valenglick's other operations, too, as my understanding, the Hacienda and the Marina and the Fremont, and he really was running it all. And Alan Glick was the straw man. He was just a figurehead. So, but Lefty was creating a lot of heat, and he was getting big, and he had this TV show, and the people were paying a lot of attention to him, and law enforcement started paying more attention to him, and he was meeting with Tony Sparatro, who was Iuffa's man in Las Vegas, shall we say, and so the Gaming Commission is blissed. Started moving on him, trying to get him kicked out of the casino, and eventually get him put in the black book so they could not even come back into a casino in Las Vegas. But during this time, Lefty creates a big stink, and he does a variety of different things. He threatens to blackmail Bob List. He threatens to what did he do?
He was bringing court actions to
court actions
against the Gaming Commission to say they had no authority. They were beyond their constitutional grounds to go after him. He was in the newspapers. That's one of the nicknames they had from him. they called him Newspaper because he had connections with a newspaper. And
And he kept showing up in it.
Yeah, and so he was all over the place.
That's a pretty good story. That one about he was buying he was offering to spend $100,000 in advertising for that one newspaper.
Right.
And in exchange, that guy was going to print good stuff about him.
Right. And he used that newspaper guy to go to Bob List and try to extort him. By saying, we have found out that you got comps at the Stardust and other hotels, and then you got your per diem on top of it. And they also started to intimate that he had brought up prostitutes to his room. So if we don't print this, you give Lefty a pass and get the board off him. That was Lefty's play, and it blew up in his face.
And a lot of the wiretaps, and you can hear a lot of these in Gangland Wire, because I was able to get all the wiretaps that were used against Lefty and the other people in the scheme in court. And they talk about, you know, all these things, and he went crazy trying to get these people off his ass. And Nick and Tuffy are continually discussing this and what can they do and what can they do. And that's where Chicago comes back into it, this relationship between Chicago. We like to have, you know, it's easy for us to say, yeah, he was connected to Chicago. Oh, yeah, we've got this story, we got that story. But when you've got the words out of their own mouth about how they're connected to Chicago, it becomes a lot better. And even better when you've got notes that Tuffy made, which Bill recovered when they served a search warrant in his house, where he talks about things going on, discussing things with Chicago, and he uses codes. And what he used was a code was 22. 22 was Joey Iupa. I'm going to play a little short clip where Nick talks about calling 22, and he needs to call him and see if it's okay if he can talk to Lefty Rosenthal directly. So play that clip, Aaron. Okay, thanks. That tells you a little bit about I'm worrying around about calling 22. And Tuffy kind of counsels him. This is from a bug, I think, in the lawyer's office, I believe. They really got open in the lawyer's office. It was pretty amazing. And so Tuffy counsels him to go to Chicago to get them to put some reins on this guy, talking about how Chicago can control Lefty. And so play that tape there, Aaron. I've got a little clip of that. Okay, thanks, Aaron. And in the end, Nick, remember, how did that go down? How did he end up, did he actually call Lefty? He did, didn't he?
Yeah, after they thoroughly discussed the ins and outs, the protocols that are demanded in this world, they finally came to the conclusion that Nick would not be out of bounds by making a direct contact with Lefty and trying to calm him down. So he reached out first to Oscar Goodman, who was Lefty's attorney, and got a little bit of background from Goodman about the situation. And Goodman was sort of not encouraging that they could rein him in. His manhood was being challenged, according to the attorney. Now this is also interesting because this is an attorney-client relationship that's being violated here in Goodman talking to Nick, which and the conversation ended by, we never had this conversation.
Would you agree that he might be opening up a tremendous big can of worms?
I might agree to that, but he would never agree.
Well, I'm not a Hesker. I know what he'd never agree to. I don't think he's ever made a mistake in his life.
Right.
You know, right. My God, I know people like that, you know.
Right, but with the timing of certain things here and things that are happening in town, it's a shame that everything's culminating at the same time. Because one thing is going to affect others. That's my opinion.
Yeah.
And there's nothing I can do to stop it.
But have you expressed your opinion to him, Constance?
Not as strongly as I'm stating it to you.
And why don't you?
Because it would get all of it.
Yeah. Listen to what. Of course, I'm just repeating it. Our conversation stays confidential.
Fine. I didn't even talk to you.
Client attorney, right?
Very good.
Thank you, buddy. And my best at home.
All right. And my best to everybody, too.
Thank you very much.
Nice speaking.
Bye.
But anyway, they decided it would be all right, and he reached out to Goodman, and then Goodman had Lefty call him.
And I've seen the transcript of that. Somehow that we could not find that tape when we searched all the tapes. It'd kill me. I just hated it.
Yeah,
we couldn't find the tape. But Nick was so diplomatic.
Oh yeah,
it would have been great to play that tape. You know, I mean, it was amazing how diplomatic he was. But he got his point across, I thought.
Go ahead.
I just was gonna say, I mean, wasn't Lefty getting direction from Chicago to calm down and cool down, much like they did in the movie?
Well, that's a good question.
I don't understand why, if he's not listening to the people, he's their man. Why is it he's listening to Nick Civella, who's just the boss of Kansas City?
Well,
and not even his.
There was a conversation, Joe Augusto reporting that Lefty had been called to Chicago, and the word was he was out. So Chicago apparently was doing something. However, when Lefty came back, typical of Lefty, the story was he talked himself back in. So somehow he had conned Chicago or got him back on his side. But they had attempted to cool him down, but it didn't work. And, of course, Kansas City didn't believe they were doing enough. It was detrimental to everyone, which eventually came out. But maybe enough wasn't done. And Nick felt that maybe he could do something further.
They really did that independently of talking to the Chicago boss.
Right. They came to the conclusion Nick could do it without violating the protocol. They would not have angered or disrespected Chicago. He could go ahead and do it. And the way he handled it was diplomatically, so even Lefty couldn't really complain. Because he did handle it really well.
He didn't threaten him at all.
No, no. And he tried to tell Lefty what Lefty was telling him. He was not really what was going on. He was just glossing it over. But he didn't come out and say you're full of you know what. He said, all right, well, you know, you know what you're doing. You know what the ramifications are. Mainly he said, do you have it under control? And, of course, Lefty said he did. And of course he didn't, but Nick made his attempt, and it really was not effective.
Yeah, one thing Nick told him was, you know, there's a lot of people can get hurt by your actions out there.
Yeah.
And let you say, I know, I'm done with this. But he wasn't, was
no,
he?
No, just no, kept. His ego and all just prevented him from ever giving in to anybody, as far as that was concerned. And so he went his way, and it turned out to be disastrous.
So that conversation was probably kind of integral in connecting Chicago and Kansas City within the court case. I would imagine to show, you know, how they had to take each other in consideration. Wasn't there a meeting or something that Tuffy referred to? When this whole skim thing started, that he said, you remember at the meeting that, you know, how he thought it was okay for Nick to go ahead and talk to Lefty directly without asking permission from Joyce. He normally would have to ask permission.
Yeah, I think they referred to a prior meeting in Chicago. And of course, we would not have had the benefit of the entire conversation.
Yeah.
We may have had Tuffy's note. That gave them some semblance of a green light. That it, because of that, what was discussed then, they would understand. Yeah, They yeah. did. They did. See, they went over this whole. That conversation is interesting because it showed the care that was taken to discuss this completely before he picked up that phone. Because in Cosa Nostra, you know, this is the protocols, and they're strictly adhered to, and you don't disrespect another family.
Yeah. You know, another question I guess I have about this is Tuffy went out to tell Alan Glick that he had to sell out the casino. But that was, you know, Chicago. I mean, he wasn't Chicago's guy. He wasn't anybody's guy. But Chicago was kind of running the Stardust. They should have been the big duck in the Stardust because Lefty was their guy, and he was working right directly for Alan Glick, and he was complaining about Alan Glick. And so Tuffy was given the job, not Joey Lombardo out of Chicago. Seemed like he should have been given the job. He's the one that's more Schenker, but Tuffy gets the job from Kansas City to go out and tell Alan Glick, you know, you're out or we're going to kill you and your kids.
Mr. DeLuna's demeanor is very vulgar, coarse, and he used many profanities. He said that he and his partners are sick of having to deal with me. He informed me that it was their desire to have me sell the Argent Corporation immediately and to announce the sale as soon as possible. He said that in the event I didn't take his threat seriously, that I might find my life expendable, and he went on to inform me that I might not find my children's lives expendable. Then he looked down at a piece of paper and gave me the names and ages of each of my kids.
Well, I think that, and there's several other instances. For example, when Alan Glick was called on the carpet before this, who did he meet with?
With
Nick Civella. That was when Nick Civella told him, you get your act in order, you owe us money, we're your partners. Why did Nick do that and not Chicago? I think it goes to the bond and the respect they had for Kansas City and Nick and his people. Because I think even Tuffy impressed them. You know, Tuffy was an impressive guy. Not as cool as Nick and as suave, but he handled himself well. I think it's an instance of their bond and the respect that IUPA had for Nick and his ability to handle things.
And could get it done and not bring any extra heat down on him. Not all of a sudden have the feds all over him.
Right, and it was also Nick who excoriated on many occasions Frank Ballesteri, the boss in Milwaukee.
No, really?
Oh, yeah. Called him Fancy Pants, and that was his nickname.
Right, and he didn't like that nickname. No, I read that.
Yeah. And, I mean, he dominated Ballesteri, although it was Ballesteri who made the first contact with Glick. He was the one who brought Glick in. But Nick seemed to take control of this operation.
It seemed like it, yeah.
Yes. But I think those are signs of that respect.
Was part of that maybe because of the history of some of the violent nature that Nick also had?
No,
you know,
I think
some of his tactics and some of the things that happened in Kansas City.
I don't think Nick would have been considered a violent person, not as violent as Chicago.
Yeah.
He was a very polite and mannerly man. He would always stop and come over to me and ask me how my day was going. He was just a perfect gentleman. During the time I was working there, I became engaged, and he came over, and the topic came up, and he asked to see my ring, and he took my hand, and he congratulated me, and could not have used better manners or been more gracious. And it was a little hard to see his name on papers and then meet the person, and somehow they never quite gelled in my head that those were the same people. It was very difficult.
You know, I mean, Nick was more prudent in his murders. And so I don't think it was that. I think it was simply a matter of respect and stature. I think that's was a strong indication, something that we overlooked in Kansas City for many years with this guy. Thought he was the boss of a small family. I think Nick had great stature.
Yeah, a lot of respect.
Yes, and that straw man case, the Vegas skim case, really brought out many examples of that. You know, Nick, who orchestrated that meeting in Chicago with IUPA rather than Chicago. You know, he wanted the meeting, and they said, okay, sure. So there were many, many examples that pointed to that.
Now, that's another interesting Chicago connection. Play that conversation with Lefty Rosenthal ended like this, and this is not from the tape because I don't have it, but this is what Nick telling Tuffy.
I said, my advice to you is you lack of better words, cool. Cool is the best word you can use.
So there's another connection in Chicago that doesn't, I'm not sure how far back it goes. I don't know a lot about this. Chicago police sergeant. No, Stompy. Anthony Shavola Sr. He had a son, Anthony Shavola Jr., who was a Chicago policeman.
That's their blood relative of Nick.
What was their relationship?
Nephew. He was a nephew. He was, that was his sister Esther's son.
Okay.
And
so she married a guy named Shavola.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. And we also had George Shavola down here, who they gave a big union job to. That was a brother. But Stompy Shavola became a sergeant on the police department, and then his son became a police officer. And they were bent, completely bent.
Did they have any kind of jobs up there? Do you know, were they just street policemen? And so, you know, if you're a policeman, you at least can get in a lot of places and flash your badge and do a lot of things. They weren't never involved with the intelligence unit or anything.
No, they were precinct people.
Yeah.
But nobody ever made any connection between him and Nick Shavola. No one ever made a connection.
Oh, we knew about Stompy. Oh, that connection and relationship was well known.
Like he
absolutely
got on the force, and everyone overlooked it.
Well, no,
Chicago PD, they didn't care.
They didn't care.
Hey, this is Chicago PD. This ain't Kansas.
Give Stompy a job, and he got it.
Probably.
Well, yeah. I mean, probably they didn't do a background and find out who was. Who his uncle was, obviously, or else they didn't care. Chicago never got over prohibition and all in their department, and maybe still haven't. I don't know. I think they're cleaned up a lot, but for years it was pretty bad.
Yeah,
and that wasn't unusual for someone like Shavola to be working. We didn't know he was a skim courier until later.
Right. That's what he did in the skim. He helps carry the money around.
Right.
Which is big. That's perfect cover. If you get stopped, you know, say, hey, I'm off duty copper here.
Sure. And he could come to Kansas City because that's his uncle. You know, I'm going to visit family. What's wrong with that?
Had family.
Just like it was the skim courier for the trap was a junket operator. So. Sure, I'm going to Vegas regularly. I'm a junket operator. So they chose these people carefully, but Shavola brought the Stardust skim down to Chicago, to Kansas City, and then he would bring the trap skim that they were sharing with Chicago. He'd bring that back. So it was a nice conduit there.
Yeah, interesting. Now, and you mentioned what was the segue for me. I remembered this. Is you mentioned about this, you mentioned meeting that Nick Shavola asked to have with IUPA, and that was going to be at Anthony Shavola's house.
House, right.
Pretty interesting stuff is, and I'm going to play just a little bit of this because you won't understand any of it. They made all the setups in Sicilian, in the native language. And as I was reading the transcripts, I thought it was another interesting thing. Police kind of lingo, I think, in that Nick was really concerned about security, and he was concerned about like what wine they were going to have, and concerned about the food, and where the relatives were going to be during the time, and how he could drive into a garage, I think, drive right into a garage so you wouldn't be seen.
Right.
And really in great detail about this meeting, all in Sicilian. And, of course, the FBI is listening to this, and you have Sicilian. Could you understand it, Bill?
Partially. Lee Flossie, who was my partner, was a native speaker. And so between us, mainly Lee, we knew what it was.
You better interpret it.
Yeah.
Your ability to speak or understand Sicilian was based on education or just experience working in the field?
Well, I spent... one of my assignments was at language school.
Okay.
So that got me into the organized crime program. So I had some back. And my mother's Italian, so I had some Italian to go before I went to the language school. And Sicilian is a lot different.
Is it a romance
language?
Huh?
Is it like Italian, a romance
language? Well, it's Italian, but it's a... corrupted version of it, of Italian. It's a difficult language for someone like me who is taught, but a native guy like Lee picked up a lot of it, even though he spoke good Italian himself.
Huh.
But Sicilian is a
like a dialect.
It's a dialect.
Would it be akin to if you were from the South and speaking English?
No,
it's even more different then.
If you would say that Southerners are hard to understand at times and have different
some different words, nouns maybe, and
they're sort of bastardized words, and all. There would be Italians. My father was a native speaker. He spoke brilliant Italian, and he would not have understood Sicilian.
Okay, interesting. I never thought about that before.
But it's a dialect. I mean, much of it is Italian, but it's a dialect with some substantial changes.
Okay. So I guess we probably ought to wind this on up now. We're getting on up about 40
minutes. Is there a clip you want me to play there?
But yeah, I want you to. And one thing that he says is he, when Nick's so concerned about security, and he says, "Oh, he says my son," he said, "he'll go out and sweep the streets just before the meeting."
Yeah.
I thought how interesting. Kind of a police. I'm going to go out and sweep the streets. Going to go out and look around just before the meeting. Play this little short clip here, Aaron, and you won't understand any of it, but you can get a feel for what that sounds like. Okay, interesting. Those of y'all who speak Italian out there, you know, I once tried to learn Spanish, and I was trying to say it, speak it around work and there at the police department, and somebody said, "Well, you're speaking Spanish with a hillbilly accent." That may be what Bill, when he speaks a Sicilian, he may be speaking it with a hillbilly accent. Yeah. We don't know.
Yeah.
Anyhow, so I want to finish up. It's kind of an interesting story about this meeting because of where you had to try to, you tried to bug the place. So, remember, this is a policeman's house. You're not going into Josephine Harlow's house, are you? You're going into a policeman's house. So there were some problems with that. And so tell a bit about that, and then we're going to wind this on down.
Yeah, well.
This is in Chicago. And
yeah.
What part of Chicago is this?
I don't recall a neighborhood, but it was a neighborhood in Chicago, two family up and down.
Like a brownstone.
Old neighborhood.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was east side, west side, or what. I don't know Chicago that well, but
it was Anthony Chivola's.
Chivola lived downstairs, and his relative, either a mother-in-law or some relative, lived upstairs. The meeting that was planned was for upstairs. Translated the Sicilian, we're going to meet upstairs. They're going to get the old lady out of her apartment. It'll be free. So our guys, I don't know how they did it, to tell you the truth, in this neighborhood, and he's a policeman, and it's a resident, but they got a mic in upstairs, and we're all set. The meeting takes place, and we're hearing nada, nothing. What turned out is that when they got there, Joe Ayupa had a heart condition, and they said he couldn't make, there's no elevator in this brownstone, he couldn't make it upstairs. So they switched everything to the downstairs apartment, and we were left holding the bag.
Didn't bug both apartments.
No, because the probable cause was right there in front of us.
We're going to meet upstairs.
If they had said we're going to use the house, we could have maybe told the judge, we don't know which one it is, give us permission for both. But when we had the conversation identifying the location specifically, that was our probable cause, and we couldn't go beyond it. Now, we did get some playback on other conversations recorded in Chicago as to what was discussed, but we never got that once-in-a-lifetime meeting.
That would have been a meeting between the boss of Chicago and the boss of Kansas City. Yeah. That's
I don't care what they said. I wanted to hear it.
Yeah, exactly. So, all right. Well, you know, folks, we haven't made like a single storyline all the way through other than kind of showing you the history. It's not one case we dealt with, but kind of the history of the Kansas City mob and the Chicago mob, and brought it from the earliest days up until the 70s and 80s, and when the heads of the mobs in Chicago, Milwaukee, and Kansas City were all convicted and sent to jail basically for their lives. Joey Iuppa went to jail. Basically, he got out of jail and died shortly thereafter. Tuffy went to jail out of the Skim trials, and when he got out, he died shortly thereafter. Nick Civella died before the trial. Mm-hmm. Cork went to jail for a long time, his brother, and he died in jail. Mm-hmm. Charlie Mortina, he died shortly after. Jackie the Lackey, Jackie Cerrone, another mob boss that went to jail out of this, he died shortly thereafter. Frank Bellatieri,
they're all dead.
They all died shortly after getting out of jail. It totally decimated the Midwest mob.
What about Joey the Dove?
Huh?
Joey Lombardo,
no.
Joey Doves, Joey Iuppa, he went to jail for the skin trials, and he died shortly after he got out. He's a really old man.
Yeah. Joey Lombardo was convicted in another big mob case in Chicago and is in jail now.
Right. But he was convicted in this for trying to bribe Howard Cannon, I believe.
Yeah.
Out of the Dorfman. And they killed Dorfman, who was going to be a witness probably, or they were afraid he was. They killed Dorfman.
They're afraid, yeah.
Lombardo had a short term in jail, came out. And then if you're a big mob reader, mob book reader, the book called The Family Secrets Trials in Chicago. And that's one of the better books I've read. It really was well-researched and well-written about the Chicago mob more up in the 70s and 80s. And Lombardo, whoever was it, Nick Calabrese, turned state's evidence in that, and he put Joey Lombardo in for some murders, and he died jail, and he never got to kill Morris Schenker, the casino owner, but I bet he scared him a little bit. I bet Mr. Schenker was really happy when all that straw man search warrants were served, and everything went into disarray, and he never had to pay that money to kick it back to Alan Dorfman.
Well, what happened to Dorfman?
Dorfman got killed. He got killed.
Lefty Rosenthal, didn't he die of natural causes?
Who?
Lefty Rosenthal?
Later in life. Lefty just dropped out of sight.
And never.
There was an attempt to kill him with a bomb. It's a very opening scene in Casino. That's the bomb attempt on Lefty Rosenthal.
At the end of all of this.
And he came out and
he ended up in Miami and died in Miami.
He had a sports gambling website.
Didn't he become an informant?
Well, there's a reporter out there in Las Vegas that said he was a top echelon mob informant for the FBI all along. But nobody will admit that. So nobody ever admits that out of the FBI, whether you were an informant or not.
And Dorfman was killed by the mob?
Dorfman was killed by the mob, yeah. Probably because he was co-defendant with Joey Lombardo in this attempted bribery of Howard Cannon, the senator from... Mm-hmm.
And they were afraid that he was going to talk.
I think they're probably afraid he would talk. Either that or the skim trials. He had a lot of heat on him.
It was before the skim trials.
It was before the skim trials.
Yeah.
Was that before they even knew that before we served the search warrants?
It may have been. I don't know the date, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure that they... I think we were still on the wire.
Okay. Interesting.
You want to download the Gangland Wire Crime Stories podcast. You also want to get the DVD, Gangland Wire, documentary about the skim in Kansas City and the turf war over the city market.
And buy Bill's book, Mobsters in Our Midst, so you can compare and contrast.
And Open City.
And Open City.
If you want to know the
and
history.
And download my app, Kansas City Mob Tours.
That's right.
And subscribe to my blog. Well, I've got too much going. Okay, let's quit this for now. One last thing. Don't forget my favorite nonprofit, First Call. If you have a problem with alcohol or drugs yourself, or you have, particularly if you have a relative, a friend, a son, a daughter, a grandmother, a grandfather, a spouse, a sibling that has a problem with alcohol or drugs, make First Call your first call. They have connections with all the resources to help people with addiction problems in Kansas City. They'll do an assessment for you. And you can call them at 816-361-5900 or go to www.firstcallkc.org. I think I said .com in one of my earlier things, but you'll figure it out. Just Google First Call Kansas City and or go to Facebook. I think that's all I've got.
At facebook.com/firstcallkc.
There you go. All right. Good night, Bill.
Good night. Thank you for having
Thank
me.
You.
It was great. It was a pleasure.
Good night, Aaron.
Good night.